This is The Blade and Beyond with the DC Dynamic Duo. Learn every detail about life on both ends of the knife. And now, live from Washington, D.C., your hosts, board-certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. Michael Somanik, and board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Troy Pittman.
Everybody, welcome to The Blade and Beyond. I'm Dr. Troy Pittman, and it is Sunday, February 20th, episode 16.
I am Dr. Michael Somanik. Yes, episode 16. We're making it.
And we're having a celebration.
What are we celebrating? Why did you throw that music in?
So our podcast has now been downloaded over 1,000 times.
Oh my God.
I know, it's crazy, right?
It's amazing.
And last week's episode, episode 15, got more downloads in a week than any of our other broadcasts.
So perhaps more people are picking it up now.
I'm hoping so.
The interest level is increasing.
I know. I love it. I love it. So keep listening. We really appreciate all of your support.
Absolutely.
So how's it going?
Fine. Why do you ask? Do I look worried?
No. I feel a little tired because we actually did something two weekend nights in a row.
And I'm exhausted.
I'm so deconditioned from quarantine that going out two nights in a row just like really takes it out of me.
Yeah, and we didn't like blow it out. We went to a dinner at our neighbor's.
You're right.
It's not like we were clubbing.
No, we weren't clubbing.
I'm drinking lemon water. I'm hydrating. I'm cleansing today.
Perfect. Okay, so we're going to start today talking about the topic of I have 10-year-old breast implants, now what? This is a blog that has been on our website and gets so much traffic. And I think that it's something that everybody is interested in.
Well, there's a lot of implants out there, so a lot of people should be interested in this.
Right. So for those of you out there who are considering implants or who have implants and you're at the 10-year mark, there are a couple of maintenance things that you should all be doing. And it's three main things. One is everybody out there, all women, should be doing a self-breast exam. Monthly.
Okay.
And so whether you have implants or you don't have implants, you should be doing a self-exam. The other thing is you should be getting regular imaging. So women who don't have a family history of breast cancer should start getting their first mammogram at age 40 and then be getting a yearly mammogram at age 40.
Did that change recently?
It goes back and forth. It's been 40 and then 50 and then back to 40. And then there are real...
It's a big range.
Well, there's a discrepancy between the recommendations of the Institute of Medicine and the American Cancer Society. And so American Cancer Society says breast cancer screening should start with yearly mammograms at age 40. And so that's what we really go by. Mm-hmm. Institute of Medicine is more insurance-based, trying to save money with healthcare. And so they're not really looking at data quite as closely as American Cancer Society. So self-exam, mammograms, and then for those of you with implants, you should be following up routinely with a board-certified plastic surgeon who is a cosmetic breast specialist.
Well, how often for that?
So I see my patients about every 2 years with implants.
You know most people aren't doing that.
I know most people aren't doing that. So those are kind of the three things, if you have implants, that you should be doing. So now where did this whole 10-year thing come from?
Well, wait, I want to go back to the third thing, because why, if everything is going well and you feel your implants are not causing any issues, why should they follow up with you every 2 years? What are you doing?
That's a great question. So women, let me be a little bit more clear. Women with saline implants generally do not need to if they're not having a problem and they're happy with their implants, they do not need to be following up. The reason that we want to see women every 2 years is we want to make sure that the implants feel good, that they don't feel like they're developing capsular contracture or a rupture. So with silicone implants, you can have a silent rupture. And so the new FDA guidelines say that women with implants should have their first high-resolution ultrasound or MRI at 5 or 6 years after having the implants put in. And so if you've had no imaging and you've had your implants for 10 years, it's time to get on board and have your high resolution ultrasound or your MRI.
So you'd recommend an MRI if they followed up with you routinely around 5 years.
Or a high resolution ultrasound.
Or high resolution.
Okay. Ultrasound's a little bit less invasive. And if there's an issue seen on ultrasound, then we send them for MRI.
Got it.
And we actually have a little ultrasound device in our office where we can look at the implants as well on a routine basis.
Mm. Okay, perfect.
Okay, so where did the 10-year thing come from? So we would tell women that they would need to have their implants replaced about every 10 years because the rupture rate of the fourth generation implants at 10 years was up to about 24-25%.
I mean, that's high.
So one in four women would have a rupture. That's where that came from. However, now with two of our manufacturers, we see the rupture rates are much, much lower, like 8% at 10 years, because they're gummy bear cohesive fifth generation implants.
So they stick together more. So that's why you wouldn't even know you had a rupture, even if it did.
Right. And so when you look at the MRI cohort, when they look at women who've had implant ruptures, more implant ruptures are detected with that imaging than women just coming to the table and saying, I think I have a rupture because I'm developing capsular contracture or my breast is feeling softer. So the silent rupture rate may be a little bit higher. But there's always kind of this philosophical question, if the implant's not causing you a problem and it is ruptured, do you need to do anything? And I think from a medical standpoint, we are obligated to replace an implant that's ruptured, even if it's not leaking anything.
Right. I would definitely, if I had breast implants and they were silicone and there was a concern for a rupture or it had been diagnosed as a rupture, I would absolutely want it changed out.
Right. So, and then there are other reasons at 10 years why women may want a revision. So 10 years, a lot of women who got implants when they were younger, they've been pregnant, they've breastfed. So their skin envelopes are getting loose and they may want a lift. I always say that breast goals change with age. And so after 10 years of having implants, there are some women who want larger implants. There are some women who want smaller implants. There are some women who don't want their implants at all. So the 10-year mark is kind of a time to think about that. But no one who comes in who's had implants at 10 years, who's having no problems, MRI is totally normal, there's no reason that those implants have to be taken out just because it's been 10 years.
So it's kind of an arbitrary number.
Well, it was an arbitrary number that was based on old data.
So I don't think we have an answer then in terms of what someone should do. It doesn't mean they necessarily need to get their implants switched out at 10 years, right?
That's right. So, I mean, I think that the goal here is to say you've had your implants for 10 years. If you love your breasts, you're not having any issues, get your imaging and move forward. There's no reason to bother the implants if they're not bothering you. However, at 10 years, a lot of women are going to have soft tissue changes. They can have malpositions of the implant. So over time, the implant kind of falls out of its pocket or starts bottoming out.
Mm-hmm.
Women with saline implants develop something called lateral breast drift. So the saline implant almost creates like a water wave, like water
like
on
a waterbed phenomenon.
Kind of. And so it causes erosion of the tissues laterally. And so I would say most women that I see with saline implants at 10 years, when they lay down, the implants tend to drift out toward the side, toward their armpits, just because there's been kind of a dissection. That's the path of least resistance.
Well, that's not cute.
It's not cute at all.
I would definitely get that revised.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, all the things I don't have to worry about with an implant.
Thank God you don't have implants. but for those of you out there who do have implants, any questions about this, DM me come and see me in the office.
The other thing this is a total side note, how effective is a mammogram on a large implant? How effective is a mammogram on a breast with a large implant?
Great question. So when women have implants, they do something called an Eklund view, which the mammogram plates are positioned in a way that the breast tissue is moved away from the implant. Oh. And so the implant doesn't necessarily obscure a lot of seeing a lot of all of the breast tissue. This was much bigger deal before we had 3D mammograms. Mm-hmm. So now with a 3D mammogram, they can kind of go all the way around the breast and see the breast tissue. Yes, a large silicone implant can block the lateral edges, lateral and medial edges of the breast. Although in most places now, they're doing 3D mammograms, so it's not as much of an issue.
Which is why your exam is so important.
Right. And I will say that there is really no utility of mammogram in detecting an implant rupture, particularly with fifth generation implants. A mammogram is truly just an X-ray of the breast tissue. And right. So the implant, whether it's ruptured or not, it's going to pretty much look the same. Again, unless you have a saline implant and all of the saline has fallen out of the implant, but the patient's going to know that because it's going to, you know, it's going to look like they had got a flat tire.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I feel like I know so much more about why 10 years is of some significance for breast implants.
Exactly.
I do tell some people, on a total side note, about facial implants are very different.
Oh, God.
No, they are. The chin implant, you don't have to get removed. Because some people do come in and say, like, oh, is it like a breast implant that I need to get replaced every 10, 15 years?
And well, facial implants don't rupture because they're solid pieces of silicone.
Right,
They're not a silicone shell with silicone gel inside.
Right.
They're not gel at all. They're almost like a wax, like candle.
Any talk about sixth generation implants?
No.
Okay. So fifth generation is like the best, here to stay for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the fifth generation implants are the best implant technology that we've had in the history of implants. But, you know, there are research and development people all over who are trying to find ways to improve things.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on to...
In the news.
So there is an article that came out from University of California, San Francisco, of some research that was done that they found that exercise alters the brain chemistry to protect aging synapses.
Hmm.
And this couples with some research that was done with our alma mater, where we met 15 years ago and trained, Rush University in Chicago, who has an amazing neurology department. But they found that when elderly people stay active, their brains make a specific class of proteins that actually enhances connections with synapses. Because as you know, as you get older, you develop some toxic proteins in your brain that when they do build up, that's kind of the signs of Alzheimer's. And you start having memory difficulties and those synapses can't fire. So I thought this was some, you know, great research to reinforce. I don't think it's anything groundbreaking, reinforcing that a healthy lifestyle and an active lifestyle really keeps your brain fresh.
So is it a healthy, active lifestyle or is it exercising?
It's physical activity. So they didn't really
go for walks.
Yeah, probably. And, you know, I think that there's so many stories that you hear of like people that retire and they end up not doing anything and their brain just kind of falls apart.
Yeah.
And I've seen that over and over and over again on even some of my close family members. So it just reinforces for everyone out there, really maintaining that active lifestyle into your later years is going to keep your brain as fresh as it can be and prevent you from getting Alzheimer's. Because I mean, it can be really devastating.
Well, not just Alzheimer's, but dementia. There are so many other types of dementia that that people who are aged can get.
I know, I get anxiety thinking about it. What if I get dementia?
I hope you don't.
Okay, so that's all I have for In the News today. We're going to move on to our next segment, which is we're going to talk about laser resurfacing. And the reason I was inspired to talk about it today is because you lasered my face about 39 hours ago on Friday evening.
Friday evening date night started with me doing a CO2 laser on you.
I know, I really felt like I needed a refresher, and this is the exact thing that I needed. Now, I'll take a few steps back. I did not have the CO2 resurfacing that you're probably thinking of that is really used for true resurfacing of wrinkles, texture, all of those things. That does carry with it about 7 to 10 days of recovery. You did a very light laser on me with the CO2, kind of like about 1/10 of the setting that we would normally use.
And what that ends up doing is it almost gives you like a chemical peel.
Kind of. It's really superficial. I only had numbing cream on for maybe 25 minutes. And mm-hmm. when, you know, you checked in with me while you were doing it, and it was really tolerable. I mean, there were some areas that were a little sensitive. And
what was the most sensitive?
I think some areas of the forehead. Right? Yeah, the hairline. And maybe that was because the numbing cream. I didn't push it up into my hair like that. But it was really well tolerable. I felt kind of sunburn for, I don't know, maybe an hour or two afterwards. Did we go out to mm-hmm. dinner? I'm like blanking. Yeah, we went out to dinner.
And you didn't look, you weren't scaring people at the next table.
No, not at all.
Well, with your face.
Not yet. So, and I've been just sort of heavily moisturizing with some growth factors and some of our moisturizers from the office. And I did like a very light exfoliation today.
Mm-hmm.
Very light with a washcloth.
Because you were kind of, you know, what's interesting is I feel like when patients have the CO2 laser surgically, they get really gritty. But they don't really peel off in sheets like a chemical peel.
That's right.
But with this lighter laser treatment, you were kind of peeling. It almost looked like you had had a chemical peel around your nose and your mouth.
Yeah, I feel like I've had a chemical peel mm-hmm. around my eyes right now, actually. That's where the skin is like really gritty. And I was able to remove some of the grittiness. But after a weekend, I'm ready to, you know, I'm going to go to the office tomorrow regardless of how I look. But I think it's going to be really presentable.
Oh, for sure.
For like a 72-hour turnaround, and my skin's already starting to get that glow to it, which I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, your skin looks, actually, other than being a little bit pink, your skin looks amazing.
Yeah, if you look in a 10x mirror, which I do every once in a while, you can kind of see the little dots, the little tracks of the laser. But to like just a casual observer, I don't think they can notice much. So it led us into a larger conversation about laser resurfacing. And it is such a popular procedure for both of us to recommend for our patients mm-hmm. because, well, why do you love recommending it?
Well, I mean, I think with the CO2 laser, you can treat so many things on the skin. So sun damage that we would traditionally do IPL for. So sunspots, sun damage, dyschromias of the skin, little pigmented marks. The CO2 laser is so effective at actually lifting that pigment out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a poor size reduction that comes along with that.
Which so many people complain about.
Yeah.
So many.
And because we're treating the epidermis so aggressively, it helps with fine lines. It helps with deeper wrinkles for the lower eyelids. It helps tighten lower eyelid skin.
Almost like a surgical result.
Yeah. So those are the reasons. I mean, or this peel, it's really, we call that the Fraxis Pro.
Ultra light peel.
And that is something for patients, particularly this time of year. They're a little dry. They've got some dead skin cells, and they want that lifted off to give themselves a little bit of a refresh. Doing that in the office, it's amazing. You know, it's amazing what that does.
Yeah, I mean, for this, I typically tell people this is for sort of someone who's looking to just get a little pick-me-up.
Yeah.
It's not for someone that is like truly looking for that wrinkle reduction, etc. But getting one of these treatments once every 4 to 6 weeks for, I would say, 2 or 3 treatments can really turn your skin around with not a lot of commitment.
But you're doing a lot of CO2 resurfacing with your facelifts.
Almost universally, if their skin type is appropriate, because it is the icing on the cake that removes any residual wrinkles that are left on their face. Some people are worried about the effects of it because they've seen people out there, particularly older ladies, that look like porcelain dolls. And they don't want to look like that. Almost like all the pigment has been removed from their face, mm-hmm. which is, you know, not a great look. And that is from those CO2 lasers that were the old ones that were not fractionated. They were fully ablative. So
it was a blowtorch.
Every single square centimeter of your skin was lasered. Versus now with the fractionation, we can control the density of the laser, but say we're leaving 30 to 40% of your skin untouched, maybe a little less than that. But there are healthy zones that basically recruit your fibroblasts and your collagen producing cells to heal the areas that you've lasered, which is why we don't damage permanently those melanocytes or those pigment producing cells within the skin. So you will not look like a porcelain doll afterwards. You will still have some residual sun damage left on your face. It's not going to be able to lift all of it, but your skin looks so much better. And Leanne, our coordinator, she wouldn't mind me talking about it. She's been lasered as well. And it's been probably around 8 or 9 months, I would say, since she had her laser. And something she noticed was not just after she healed 2, 3, 4 weeks later, 3, 4, 5 months later, she started getting additional compliments on her skin. And she even felt like her skin started looking better. And that's what recent studies, or our previous studies, about 4 or 5 years ago, a dermatologist did a study and followed patients for up to 12 months and found histologically with skin biopsies, those punch biopsies on the areas that were lasered, they continued to show improved collagenesis. So that makes total sense.
Yeah, for sure.
And I do tell people what you see is not necessarily what you get at 2 weeks once you feel your skin is healed. It's going to continue to improve, continue to change over time.
I think without a doubt, every patient that I recommend CO2 laser, it follows kind of the same trajectory. So we recommend CO2, we talk about it, they get excited. They go home, they get on the internet, they type in CO2 laser, they see the old unfractionated results where everyone looks like a burn victim and they have gauze on their face.
Yes.
Then they call completely terrified. So for those of you that are out there listening who are considering CO2 laser, this is a fractionated laser. And so you need to make sure you're looking at fractionated laser results, because really, even your surgical patients, it's about a week of downtime.
Yeah. And that second week you're pink. So you're not perfect, but you can kind of start incorporating a little bit of concealer, a little bit of powder or foundation on your skin if it tolerates it.
Right. So there are kind of three ways to approach CO2 laser. And this is kind of what I say to patients. So there's obviously the patient who's coming in, they're under general anesthesia and they're getting the deluxe
laser, my face away,
laser, yes. laser. For those of you that are nervous about having this done with you awake in the office, we can also do a little bit of a deeper CO2 laser under sedation. So you come to the operating room, the anesthesiologist gives you a little bit of propofol, which is kind of the medicine that you get when you're having a colonoscopy. You fall asleep for 15 minutes, and that 15 minutes we're able to do the CO2 treatment. Or for those of you that want to avoid that, there is the light peel that we were talking about that you had. But to put things in perspective, the light peel, the setting on the machine was 15, right? We did
12 millijoules.
12. So you were at a 12. If you're having it done when you're asleep in the operating room, you can have it done at like 90.
Or 99.
So, yeah. So that gives you kind of a litmus as to how much more aggressive we can be with you asleep.
Yeah, you don't want to be awake for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
know. Well, 99, you were like squirming around your hairline at 12.
Yes, yes. I do not mess around when I laser resurface people's faces. I'm results driven, but I never even create the expectation that they should be awake for that setting, because it's not meant to be done under those circumstances.
Yeah, for sure.
I know some of my colleagues out there that do lasers routinely, that do like full face blocks, and they pre-medicate the patient, and they're able to get the patient through it. But we have the luxury of having our anesthesiologists at our disposal and our surgery center, and for a little extra cost and to be asleep for 15 minutes, it is worth every single penny.
Oh, for sure.
Now, we kind of went to the two extremes. There's the ultralight peel, there's the full resurfacing, but there's also kind of like an in-between. Mm-hmm. If you have about 4 to 6 days or 4 or 5 days that you want, we can go a little bit higher on the laser that can give you a little bit more results. And that's what makes it so customizable for patients. And not every patient is the same. Not every skin type is the same. So it depends what your needs are. That's why a consultation is so important, to look, assess what your goals are, and see how much sun damage, skin texture changes, etc., that we're targeting to best drive the optimal treatment for your skin.
For sure. I love the CO2 laser.
I love it too. That's why I did it this weekend. I'm going to try and put some, maybe I'll take a picture and put it on my story so you guys can see what it looks like at, we're at like a day and a half, almost mm-hmm. 2 days.
48 hours.
Yeah, almost this afternoon.
47.
Yeah.
Six.
Oh my gosh. Hours,
something like that.
Your yeah. math right now. Okay. Well, that's great.
Okay. Well, we're done. That's all we have to talk about today, I guess.
Listen, I hope everyone has a great Sunday. Hope you learned a little bit about our content. Enjoy your week. Be inspired and do something amazing.
Have a good week, everybody. We will see you next week.
That's a wrap. Remember to share the podcast with your friends. Follow the docs on Instagram at SomnicMD, at Dr. Troy Pittman, and at DC Dynamic Duo. To learn more about the procedures discussed on today's podcast, visit www.somnicpittmanmd.com. That's www.somnicpittmanmd.com.